From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made last Tuesday on Amazon.com when George Orwell's dystopian classic 1984 jumped to the number one spot on the bestseller list. Now, the book was published in 1949, and it's a standard in many high school classrooms. So why did it make its way back to the top of the charts? The phrase alternative facts has a lot to do with it. When counselor to the president Kellyanne Conway appeared on Meet the Press on January 22nd, host Chuck Todd challenged the Trump administration's claims about the size of the Inauguration Day crowd. Conway said that their press secretary responded with the claims of alternative facts. He presented alternative facts. Now, that reminded many people of the term doublethink from Orwell's novel. It just means holding two contradictory beliefs and accepting them both. So since that interview, the publisher has had to order an additional 75,000 copies of 1984, and it's not the only book with a political statement that's on the bestseller list right now. The Handmaid's Tale, Brave New World, Fahrenheit 451, and Animal Farm are also on the list. And literature is just one form of art that has the power to comment on current events and create social change. And this hour, we're talking about some of those examples, as well as what's going on in our own community. Our guests are visual artists, performance artists, photographers, and educators whose projects have a strong message. And we'll hear about all of those this hour. I'd like to welcome my guests. No rehearsal, we were just discussing for this hour. Allison Roberts is an artist and co-founder of Impact Interactive and the founder of the comedy group Astrofest. Thanks for coming on the program, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Richard Roberts is Allison's father, also an artist and former art director for the Democrat and Chronicle. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jonathan Niketha is an actor, performance educator with Impact Interactive, and senior assistant director of the Multicultural Center for Academic Success in RIT's Division for Diversity and Inclusion. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And Arlene Thaler is a socially engaged photojournalist. Arlene, welcome back.
Thank you.
Listeners, we also want to hear from you. If you're an artist or you're inspired by art with a message, you can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, you can call 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@wxxi.org. Or you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. I'd like to start with Allison and Richard, because you have an exhibition coming up. And it's a father-daughter exhibition. It opens this Friday, correct?
Correct, yep. Yep, we're at the Williams Gallery at the Unitarian Church.
Mm-hmm. And it's called Feathers, Faces, and Foliage. And I know there's one piece of that exhibit that has sort of a strong message in it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I've dedicated an entire wall. It's kind of called the Rochester Diversity of Women. Entire wall of women. It's probably about, I think there's 27 to 28 portraits that I've done in lots of different medium. And it started because I was feeling very stressed and upset about sort of everything that was going on politically and predominantly with people of color, and had numerous conversations with friends of color about how they were feeling. And I was very upset, and I felt sort of like I didn't really know what to do. And I had this urge to paint, because that usually makes me feel better. And I started to paint the women of color that I knew, I guess as a way of honoring them, making them visible. And then that kind of launched into my wanting to honor many women in Rochester that I know who I think are doing some tremendous stuff in our community and are just really creative, wonderful people.
And how does this piece of the exhibit factor in with the overall picture? Does everything in the exhibit have a strong message in this way?
I wouldn't say that everything does. Both my father and I are very into nature, so I think that that plays a strong part of the show as well, and our connection to nature, and I guess in a way our disconnection to nature, I would say, in this day and age. Is also having an impact, I think, on how we view each other and how we view the world, because we are very disconnected to the natural world and how that impacts ecosystems that then impact humans.
Mm-hmm. And what is your medium of choice? Dick, you as well, your combination exhibit here, it seems like there's a lot to look at on Friday.
Yes, there are quite a few pieces, and there are watercolors, some oils, and acrylic paintings, and the subjects vary quite a bit. Allison has done some wonderful birds, and they're just fun to look at. And I've tried something similar, but I may put a bird in a painting. In fact, one of my friends has kidded me about putting birds in my paintings, and I keep telling them that anybody who uses a bird is going to have to rent them from me. But there's quite a cross-section in the show. And there's some, and I tend to vacillate between representational work, and then I'll jump over and do something somewhat abstract. So it varies a lot. It's just more fun for me.
And you have a very artistic family, from what I understand. You grew up painting. Allison, your mother, was a painter. You've been surrounded by art your whole life.
Yes. My mother was a painter and illustrator. She was actually the first female illustrator at Hickey Freeman back in the early 60s, which was pretty cool. And so I did grow up watching them, and it's pretty much all I've ever known. So, yeah, and my daughter is also an artist, so.
I want to open this up to all of our panelists. Arlene is a photographer and Jonathan is an actor. When you are creating something, no matter what medium it's in, what do you hope people will take away from it? Does the message differ depending on what you're creating? Is there one strong thing? Do you just want them to listen or look or learn? What's most important to you?
I'll answer that. The work that I do is going into marginalized communities and capturing what it is they're going through. And the message for me, I want the viewer to look and see if there's something they can do to help the people who are struggling within my photos. I always feel like there's going to be one group of people, one person, or an agency that can say, wow, I didn't know this was going on. I've heard about it, but I didn't know. And they can step up and come in and find a way to professionally and with their knowledge, experience, and tools help these individuals or communities out.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most important things is for audience members to be open. I think we spend so much of our time going somewhere, focused on some things, and we don't take the opportunity to, at one moment, enjoy, experience everything that's around us. And if it's the people on stage who prepared the piece, if it's the audience members who are sitting at the edge of their seats or during the intermission, spending that time to forget everything else and to create a world. Actors and cast members and members of the company can create something, but without the audience there, it's just a bunch of people spending a lot of good time together. And it's important, I think, for audience members to come prepared, not to think about the price of a ticket or the worth of the admission or the worth of what the time is worth, but to, instead of thinking about what they need to get from this experience, consider what they have to give in that moment at that time. And I think when folks do that, there's this undeniable connection that you can create. And when you run into them in Wegmans the next day, you understand, you can have a conversation about the piece that you just experienced. And that goes for theater, that goes for singing and for music as well. There's a connection that needs to be made in that moment in order for art to really exist. And I think if we're unafraid of that connection, if we push ourselves through the discomfort of making that connection, it becomes that much more important.
And Arlene, you have a lot of experience fostering connections with people who may not be interacting with the people in this room on a daily basis. You called yourself a foot soldier. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some of the projects that you've been working on where you're going into the community, you're living the lives that some of these people have in your own way to try to better understand them?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been doing this since about 2008, 2009. I had been doing a lot of street photography, and as I was taking photos and looking at them, I realized there was a theme going through my photos of homelessness, street workers, poverty. And I'd look at the photos not knowing the names, who these people were, what their stories were. So what I've done now since is immerse myself in their lives. So if it's sleeping with, cohabitating for a while with a homeless person, where they're at. And right now I'm working on a project with human trafficking, specifically the street workers over in our northwest quadrant of Rochester. And what I do is spend lots of hours out in the streets with them. Listening is the key to listening, and breaking bread is the key to immersion for me. And then also I'm able to take experiences that I've had in my life. I say suffering is a gift. I can take those experiences and make that connection with people. The immersive part of it is really a way to give me one moment, even if it lasts 6 months of living with these different communities and different people, but it gives me one moment to walk in their shoes. You know, to be homeless out in the streets for a weekend would give anyone a moment to go, oh, that's what it's like. So while I'm doing this, I've got my camera with me, and after listening and getting to know these people, they trust that I can come in and tell their story with dignity and through their way. One thing that I'm looking into now is participatory photography, where I'll have the cameras to give to people, and I'm not the vessel. Now they're telling their own story. And I've just recently come to that conclusion that we all have a story to tell, but maybe we should be the ones telling our own story.
So. How do you create a level of trust with some of the people that you're working with? They probably don't know you. You're showing up with a camera. Maybe they're afraid that they might be exploited. How do you create an intimate relationship where they know that they can trust you and that their story will be told in a respectful way?
Right. The benefit I have of being able to... So I've got a little bit of a substance abuse counseling background, and with that, you're taught very much about boundaries, healthy boundaries, not giving too much of yourself or any of yourself to your clients. So I've got that experience now where I'm on the streets. I'm not behind the desk. I can open up myself a little bit and say, this is what I've gone through, or truly I understand because I've experienced this or that. And when you open up, I believe when you open up a little bit of yourself to someone, they trust you to open up a little bit back. So it's reciprocal. The one thing that I've had to overcome is I love to talk and not so much listen for a long time. And through the work that I've done, the gift that I've gotten back is I can really listen now. I can listen to what people are saying. And that's been great. And I know, you know, I've heard we always listen to reply. We don't listen to listen. And when I switched up to listen to reply, you can tell when someone's listening to listen, or rather listen to not reply. And that is a huge part of the trust. Then the other thing is when you're sleeping, you know, in a parking garage with someone for a weekend, they're looking at you like, you must be crazy. Why are you here? And, you know, in the areas that I've been, I think that coming into someone's, an area where people are afraid to go, but I'm there, shows that I'm not afraid to be there. And there's that trust too. Mm-hmm.
I've been reading your blog, and there's some powerful stories and powerful photos.
Thank you.
Where can people find your blog?
Yep. So I've got my website/blog is at arlenethalerphotography.com. And then also I'm the current artist in resident, one of two in the photography department. And I do some blog updates on there as well. And that's rochesterarts.org.
What is the story that spoke the most to you of everything you've worked on in the last few years? Is there one person or one story that really impacted you?
Oh, absolutely. Most recently, I photographed for Post Rochester magazine as well, and I had been in my work that I'm doing with human trafficking. They had contacted me and asked if I would do a story on human trafficking. So the journalist Melanie Blow and I went out into the streets for months getting to know the girls. And one day we were walking, and there was a tree stuck up, a cat stuck up in a tree, and there was a prostitute or street worker that was standing there, and I approached her and we talked. I had known her name. Well, Melanie and I got to know her a little bit more intimately and gave her a ride back to her house. And she's a woman who wants to get off the streets, who since she was 12 was turned out into the streets. Now at 34, it's the only life that she knows. She's got several children that live with her, and right now she's I put a photo up of her daughter. It was an Instagram photo with a little pink tutu, a little two-year-old, just looking out a window, and they live in deep, deep poverty. I thought I knew what poverty was in Rochester. This is just, it was horrific. And when I put the photo up, so many people came to, there were people coming to the darkroom, dropping off diapers, formula, New York Styley Fashions on Monroe Ave, toys, winter coats from one photo. And that moment was such a defining moment for me, and that one photo can truly tell a story. That's always been my dream with what I do. And I still get people saying, how is that family doing? Can we donate more items? And that's been in the last few months. And this woman, the other day I brought her downtown, and she has a job interview now. And I think that support from the community where you, I mean, people don't support prostitutes. People don't support drug addicts or drug dealers. But to see that so many people came to her aid, it helped give her a sense of love, belonging, community, and now she's making some choices that are pretty awesome.
That is powerful.
Yeah.
Have Allison, Dick, and Jonathan, have you had experiences like that where you're working on a project or a piece or a performance and you found that it has an incredible impact, something that you could have never anticipated?
Yeah. I think both visual arts and through visual arts and through theater. I mean, one thing that pops into my mind is my comedy troupe, Astrofest. You know, you think, oh, you know, it's comedy, it's fun, you make people laugh, ha ha ha, it's light. And, but I remember very clearly a couple of times when we had done a show. Different people had come up and told us different stories. And one woman came up and said, you know, I have literally not laughed in months because I have a brain tumor and I have been very ill. And this is the first time I've been able to go out in a very long time. And to be able to laugh like this, I completely forgot that I had a brain tumor for a little while. And, you know, and another woman came up who, you know, her mother just passed away. They had tickets to come. They decided to come anyway, and how much of a difference it made to be able to just be in that moment and have some fun. And that was really powerful for me because, you know, I'm having a good time, and sure, we do it because it's fun, but humor is really important. It's really important in people's lives, you know?
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about political cartoons and satire and all that later in the hour. But Dick, have you ever had an experience or a piece of work that you thought went to a different level, that changed how you thought about your work or how it's perceived?
Well, I find that being a painter since I retired, you're more of an isolationist because you stay at home and paint. When I was working commercially, of course, I got involved with more people. And I got thinking recently about the recent political season and how I wished I had been back at the newspaper doing some political cartoons. But I'm sure some of the cartoons had an influence. You really don't get a feedback when you're working like you would in theater, perhaps, or even as a photographer, depending on where you go, and or even as an actor. You can almost see what's happening in the audience. You can see people reacting to what you're doing. But when you're sitting there in the studio just painting, you're never quite sure what the reaction is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan.
Yeah. One of the my favorite experiences here in Rochester in our theater, our fantastic theater community that's here, was doing with Shipping Dock Theater. Shout out to Barbara Biddy, the great Barbara Biddy, for casting me in it. But it was called The Exonerated, and it's a piece that was put together by the Innocence Project. And it took these real interviews that the authors created, that the authors conducted with folks who had been wrongfully convicted and placed on death row. And they took their stories, they listened, and they created this piece that wove together an opportunity to create the space for their realities, for their truth, and for validating who they were and who they are as human beings. And it was a great cast ensemble. Many of us played different roles and different characters, but one of the things that we're asked to do and urged to be mindful of is the fact that, and as an actor, it was a great lesson, is that these weren't these weren't our words. They never are, unless you're lucky enough to write what you get to perform in. But also, these weren't our stories, and they needed the care, they needed the attention, they needed the truth that we could find in every word, in every pause, in every moment that we're able to share. And just to know that there are hundreds of hours of tape of these people's stories, and we get to take these carefully selected snippets to share, there was a responsibility as an actor that I don't think I've had before. It had been about the opportunity to do what I've always loved. I'm middle child, middle of five, so I mean, middle child syndrome is real, and you know, and that's why I became an actor, I'm sure, because you need to sing for your food, so to speak, and to get away from what I wanted out of acting and what I wanted from my art, to be able to use my art as the vessel for someone else's story to be told, was something that still sits with me today.
I noticed you brought a book with you.
Yes. This is Black Theater USA, and I was looking through it as on my shelf at work. I'm a theater major of St. Lawrence University. Shout out St. Lawrence. And as a theater major, there are very few opportunities to play roles that were created for men of color. It was a predominantly white institution, about 2,000 students when I was there in the late 90s, graduated in 2000. And I went studied abroad in London. When I came back that fall, there was this African-American theater course that was being taught. And one of my favorite professors, Andrew Nurier, was teaching it, so I signed up for it. Well, she stops me right on the quad one day in that first week of classes. She says, "Jonathan, you're the only one who's scheduled to take this course. And you know, if you don't make the threshold, you can cancel the course." And so we talked about it, and she offered to still teach it. And so we met once a week for 3 hours in her office, and there was no way to hide. You had to read everything. You had to do it all. But what was great about it, and what I hold on to this, is that I always thought that as an actor that I would have to wait for someone to create a story for me to tell. And that opportunity to explore so much of African American theater, the richness of the stories, the complexity of the stories, those stories are out there. They are out there. It's our responsibility as artists to be able to find them and to tell them and to help them echo forward. And so that's why I brought this book. There's so many great pieces here. I was able to do The Raisin in the Sun when I came and started working at RIT. And that was a different experience as well, because I did that with our NTID Theater, the National Technical Institute for the Deaf at RIT. And I knew no sign language, but I was doing the voices of three characters, and I had to learn sign language. And it was great to be at a disadvantage as an artist and to tell a story that I knew that I loved. I remember watching Sidney Poitier. I remember growing up watching Danny Glover, and I saw myself on stage. But to be able, again, to use a different type of different part of my art to help someone else's truth come through, to see Lorraine Hansberry's words signed and learn the depths of emotion that as an actor I'm close to, but I didn't really explore yet, and I couldn't explore until I was a part of this production, was something that sticks out to me. But it was, I think, that moment on the quad, thinking that I'd never have the opportunity to take this course, yet someone made sure that, because it would be that important to me, that it would be that important to my development as an educator, she made accommodation for that to happen. And I thanked her recently on Facebook about it, and on her birthday, and I let her know I still think about that lesson, and I use that and involve that with my connections with my students that I make today at RIT. But this book, this was 1935 to around mid-90s, so many great pieces of theater. And now the question is, what other pieces are there? What other stories are there that need to be told, that can be told? And how can I, as an artist, not just stay inside of my lane, but expand and explore the different ways that I can help tell stories also? So that's why I brought it, because it's a great token and sort of a milestone in my life as an artist. And also a reminder that there's some more stories that I can tell, and I need to make sure I've got breath in my lungs to do that.
When you're confronting uncomfortable truths, in whatever form you're working in, what's the biggest barrier for you to overcome as an artist? So to recognize what that truth is and to find how to communicate it, what is the process like when you know you care so much about something, you know you want to work on that particular subject area, how do you go about that What is the process like?
Well, I was thinking of Impact, which is a training company.
Yeah, let's talk about what
so,
that is.
So Impact Interactive is a theater-based training company. We have an ensemble of 21 performance educators, and we use interactive theater techniques and drama techniques to create a format for dialogue and problem solving around sensitive issues. And we have a pretty diverse ensemble, but I will say, you know, one of the things that we've talked about as an ensemble and as a company is making sure that we as an ensemble are having those difficult conversations about race, gender, and issues that are happening so that we can realistically go out and talk to other organizations about the issues they're having. And those conversations are very difficult and uncomfortable and painful, but they're imperative. And it's not like you have one conversation and it's over. You know, it's an ongoing process. And I was thinking about what you were saying. Listening is really the key for me. In some of these difficult conversations, I have felt like my job really is to listen. I mean, that is my most important job, because I can't know somebody else's experience, and I have to listen in order to try and understand. So I guess my process is really listening.
Mm-hmm. And as a part of the ensemble and the company, and as one of the actors and performance who became performance educators by way of Impact Interactive, we spent a great deal of time working on it, taking our time to find truths amongst ourselves as artists, and to be able to be in tune with that. One of the things that I've appreciated about being a part of the company is when there has been an emotional time in our society, and as of late the last year, there have been a number of very striking and emotional experiences and visceral experiences that we've been going through for the first time in a long time collectively as a community. We've suspended what we've been able to do, and we focused on expressing it and sharing it. So after the elections, there was time, instead of working on pieces, we talked. Shared ideas, shared sentiments, listened to one another, and sought to have our stories told. And as a company that seeks to listen to folks' stories and incorporate lessons that they then can utilize in their worlds, that to be able to do that as artists for one another is extremely important. It's one of the things I appreciate about the work that we get to do and the company that we do keep. And
So you're tackling subjects, I'm looking from your website, sexual harassment, diversity and inclusion, family dynamics, aging and caregiver issues, relationship violence, LGBTQ issues. There's a broad spectrum there. How do you work with your company to find ways to confront all of these? How do people sign up to have the training? I'd just like you to walk us through, if people are interested in getting involved, what do you do and what does the process look like?
You mean in terms of being a company or an organization wanting to hire us to do
yes.
some work for them?
Yes.
Well, we have a website, and I think, do you have that written down there somewhere?
I don't.
Okay, well, I will give it to you in one moment.
Thank you.
Basically, we have a whole process of we meet with them, we talk about the issues they have, talk about, because the nice thing about this is it's the techniques themselves. The techniques can be used really for any issue, because mm-hmm. it's using interactive techniques to get people to talk, to raise consciousness. I don't think any of us would claim to come in and have all the answers for anybody. I think it's more the raising consciousness that's important, to be able to have a format to be able to talk and problem solve around things. And then from there, we decide kind of what program will be best suited for their needs, for the length of time they have, you know, whether it's going to be a scripted scene, whether it's going to be interactive activities, or a combo of both. So that's sort of the process.
Great. We'll take our very short break, our only break of the hour. But listeners, we want to hear from you if you're an artist, or if, again, you're inspired by art with a message, if you're a dancer, if you're a painter. You can join this conversation. Call 844-295-TALK. That's 844 295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org, and I'm on Twitter at MMACMedia. Short break and more Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on the next Connections, we sit down with a panel of local people who are concerned about the Trump administration's immigration ban. We'll hear from people who attended the local rally and those who are concerned about their safety and their future in the U.S. Then in our second hour, four-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer William Snyder joins us to talk about his career photographing the WHO. Talk to you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about art with a message. And before we jump to our break, well, actually, during our break, we were talking about the power of listening. And Arlene, you had a great comment.
Yeah, so I was thinking how the common theme through us artists that are sitting here and all the artists that I know is that listening to what people have to say. And then as artists, and when these heated situations come up with everything that we're dealing with in the world right now, we're the ones that really can take that situation, we can photograph it, we can draw it, we can write poetry about it, we can use theater, so much expression to kind of throw it back out at the community to elicit those conversations. For me, with the photography, I can go into the situation, photograph something that is pretty awful, but then people are going to look at those images, and it's my hope that they're going to say, we need to talk about this. We need to have these conversations, and that creates that dialogue. So artwork is just so powerful. It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the role of listening, especially in theater, is so important, too. And we were talking before about the connection that exists between the audience. As theater artists, Jonathan and Allison, how do you feed off of the audience, and how do you take feedback from the audience and incorporate it into your work? They're so polite. Yeah. They're nodding to each other.
No, you. Well, it's important to allow the audience the opportunity to participate in theater. At the same time, we have a story to tell, and there is something about being the constant in that particular experience. So we prepare, we listen, we create, but then we also give space for the audience. So something that might be funny one night might fall flat the next. So we can't wait for the audience. We can't expect the audience to give us energy from that piece. We have to tell the story and just be willing to wait, to listen, to feel where they are, and then move forward. So I think often about the Globe Theater and Shakespeare, which I love Shakespeare. Shakespeare in the Park here in Rochester is some of my favorite theater to do, and I've appreciated that part of my career here. But in learning about the Groundlings and how back in those days, the wealthy people would sit high and away from everyone, so they'd be towards the rear of the house and away, and so they wouldn't have to smell the common folk. And the folks who were closest to the stage had to stand the entire 3 or 4 hours that this piece was going on. So one of the things I never understood or never appreciated about it until I got to university, until I had a chance to learn at the Globe Educational Center in London, is that the Groundlings were a part of the community in a different way. So the actors would have these words, they would have the show that would go to the queen and to these royals who were further back and away, but they would have also kind of the sly remark, the wink, the nudge to the commoner who was closest to them. So the commoner got a chance to be in the space as royalty, but also get something from that connection, that community in a unique way. There's a piece in African American theater called Putting on Old Massa. So the thing. Well, you would greet and you would answer the way that you were supposed to, but at the same time talking through the double entendre or suggestions that would go over the head of some of the other folks, you could have a second conversation. And so that type of theater allowed for that second conversation, which I loved because it wasn't static. It wasn't these words that were 400 years old. It was an opportunity to connect with different people at different times using the same piece in that same moment.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Jonathan Niketha. He's a performance educator with Impact Interactive, an actor, and a senior assistant director of the Multicultural Center for Academic Success in RIT's Division for Diversity and Inclusion. My other guests this hour are Allison Roberts, artist and co-founder of Impact Interactive. She's also the founder of the comedy troupe Estrofest. Richard Roberts is her father. He's also an artist, and he's the former art director for the Democrat and Chronicle. And Arlene Thaler is a socially engaged photojournalist, and they are all here sharing their perspectives about art with a message and how art can be a tool for social change. And speaking of theater and being able to interact with audiences, I'd like to turn to comedy because there's been a lot of comedy of late that speaks to the current political climate. And I remember when I was doing some improv training at Second City in Toronto, the number one rule we had when we were thinking about sketch ideas or improv ideas was think about how you feel about the world. Don't try to be funny. Just how do you feel about the world? And that should influence whatever you write, whatever you say or do. And turning to Allie, I mean, when you're writing for Estrofest, how much satire do you incorporate into your shows? I've seen one sketch, the Bible sketch, that I think is a great example. And maybe you can tell our listeners about that.
Well, that was written by Ryan Steblin, who's a terrific comedy writer and also a videographer. And it's probably my all-time favorite sketch because, yes, it is two monks. One keeps falling asleep, dropping his pen, all kinds of things, as the other one is trying to translate the illuminated text. And so he's only catching little bits of what's said, and it's really brilliant, but it's hysterically funny, you know, catching all the the pieces that everyone would recognize and mm-hmm. forgetting about everything else. And now we realize, well, all this other stuff was being said, but it wasn't written down. And it's a brilliant piece. It's really, really funny. And so I think satire plays a pretty big part. And I think in our group, absurdity comes to mind, you know, just an absurd view of the world and kind of the weirdness and picking up on just something that would be really bizarre or that you wouldn't expect. That's what I like to write about. It's just something maybe that you wouldn't expect.
Mm-hmm. And I'll ask everyone, where do you draw the line, especially when it comes to comedy? When is it not funny anymore?
Well, usually when somebody thinks of a cartoon, there's humor involved. And I remember one that I did had no text in it at all, and it happened to be an article about perhaps abused children. And I had this little boy. You could see two adults, probably parents, pointing a direction for him to go. In other words, get out of my way or get out of the room. And so in the next panel, he's dragging his teddy bear into another room. And then he approaches a television set. And the teddy bear is sitting there next to the couch. And the little boy climbs into the set and disappears. In the last panel, you see this teddy bear sitting there with a tear in his eye. And that's how it ends. And so there was really no humor in it. And it turned out to be pretty serious. And by contrast, there was an article on that I did a cartoon for on the women's movement. And this probably had more humor to it. I had a man lying there with a lot of hair on his chest, and there was a small woman pushing a lawnmower across his chest, cutting the hairs away. And it was on the women's movement. And the only other one I can think of at the moment is an article on the shortage of priests in the church. And I had this one bishop, I guess, stirring this big pot, and there were a lot of empty boxes marked his on the floor. And a monk was standing next to him holding another box that said hers. And the caption read, "May we substitute," because there were no women in the priesthood at the time. So I don't know if it got a laugh or a grimace, but
it makes you think.
It made a message. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it created a message, and it's supposed to make you think.
What goes into creating a good political cartoon?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess if you have an article to go by, you can find something in there that you can use. If you're doing it on your own, then you just have to watch the news and see what's going on. As I said earlier, since we had a presidential election, I really wished I was back at the newspaper because I had all kinds of ideas floating through my mind. I probably wouldn't have been very popular, but the ideas were there.
I think in AstroFest, the line we draw, we decide kind of together, I think. Mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, every group kind of has its own little personality. And and if something really makes somebody uncomfortable, then it's off the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there seems to be a fine line between being smart and making a statement and then offending people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's so difficult to know where you fall. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to lose some self-awareness in those moments. And we've seen that recently with the Saturday Night Live writer who made a joke about mm-hmm. President Trump's son.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now she's suspended. So it's a tough, tough line. And I remember I read about a political cartoon from 2008, actually. And Dick, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. It was a cartoon that showed Sarah Palin speaking in tongues. I don't know if you remember this one.
Mm-hmm.
So John McCain was saying that she has a direct line to God, and then in a different panel, God said that he couldn't understand her quote-unquote right-wing gibberish. There were some other words there, but it's public radio, so we won't be using them. And so more than 750 readers from around the country told the editors of the newspaper that they were very offended, and many were Pentecostals, whose worship can include speaking in tongues. Complaints also came from mainline Christians and from Charles Martin, a Buddhist in Boulder, Colorado, who said, "It offends me." Do you think that the person who created that cartoon was thinking about any of that, or was he?
Probably not. He thought he had a good idea and produced it. Although you have to be careful, so there's no doubt about it. Whenever I think of Sarah Palin, the first thing that seems to pop into my mind is, I can see Russia from my house, and that always made me laugh. But I'm sure if I did something about that, I'd get some nasty letters. So you have to be careful up to a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think offending sometimes is what, again, elicits those conversations.
Sure.
People
Absolutely.
Are thinking it. More people are broadcasting what they think now with social media. But sometimes until you're offended about your beliefs, you don't speak up. Mm-hmm. Once you hear it, then you can get your word out too. So mm-hmm. it's not always a bad thing.
You're confronted with it.
Absolutely.
And then
have to,
yeah. But I think it has to, folks need to have a sense of dignity, and there, some you can't invalidate someone in trying in doing
listen,
that.
Right.
And I think I always go back to the thought of our comedians being the most informed people in our society. They're not funny if they're just talking about what they think from their own perspective. They have to read the news. They have to listen. They have to be out in the street. They have to hear how people speak or what's funny to folks. They have to know who their audience is in order to be funny. And there's a great responsibility with being a comedian, which is probably why I'm not one. But in terms of political satire or political cartoons. Andrea Hickerson, who's in the communications department at RIT, in one of her courses, she offers an A for anyone who can successfully get their caption idea accepted by the New Yorker for their political cartoons.
Wow.
And so everyone in the class is like, okay, I'm going to get this A. This is simple. But you never, until doing that, I never understood how much goes into marrying the image with the words. Why would this be something that the New Yorker would print? Who is the New Yorker's audience? I see it from my bubble, and I could submit it, but folks may not even understand what that is because it's just a line of text that's meant to match up to something that someone created who saw something completely different. And when you see what wins, I encourage everyone to try it and just to see, and then see the following week what actually won. It's kind of interesting thinking about the distance from that. But there's a great responsibility that goes with that. I think everyone wants to be able to do it because we can, in 140 characters, tweet something. We can come up with something that's funny. I spend like 45 minutes trying to compose the best tweets, and they all fall flat because I'm like, well, it's about immediacy, not about saying the right thing and vetting it. But I think that we have to think about what our responsibility is in our humor, and if we are, as long as we're not invalidating someone through it, I'm okay with it. And I think that's where the line is for me.
And Arlene, you carry great responsibility when you're photographing people whose stories are delicate and sensitive. And how do you balance how much to tell? How do you ask them directly? Are you comfortable with me sharing this?
Yeah. I'm pretty transparent when I go into a situation, and then it also evolves over months. They get to know my work. I was thinking about kind of switching a little bit the laughter. You know, there's no comedy in my work, the images that people see. But while I'm in my work, in the middle of it, immersed, there's so much laughter from children who are living in poverty that don't know that are living in poverty. I find that marginalized communities, to get through their days, have a lot of jokes and a lot of laughter and a lot of good stories to tell as well. I'm showing the opposite of that. So I go in, I make it very clear what I'm, you know, up to, what I'm about, that I really want to know their story, to be able to share their story. And after months of that, I think they feel comfortable and they've seen my work to know. I'd like to think that my photos, although they're grim in nature, they're beautiful. I don't think that I photograph and show the ugly side of somebody in their agony and in their suffering and in their misery. I find beauty in the images that are put forth. They're some of the most beautiful people that I've photographed. And I always, at least I almost always, bring photos back to the people to show them. There's a lot of people walking around with little bent photos in their back pocket that I've taken of them. And they also become part of it as well. They get to tell their story through me, and I make sure, I really try to make sure that it's their words or my experience with them as I see it, which, again, I have to, you know, always make sure that I've done my research also. There's so much for a woman to become a prostitute. What were the steps that brought her to that, so that I'm familiar with why this person might be in the situation that they're in? So there's a lot of research and background work that goes into the work that I do as well.
Understanding that full picture.
Yeah.
When you give people the cameras and give them the power to share stories, do you give them any direction, or how does that process work?
Well, so far I've only worked with a couple groups, and one was with Refugees Helping Refugees. For a couple days I did a after-school program with some of the kids there, and what was really interesting, you know, especially in the climate that we're living in right now, is it was a group of Muslim kids, and we were walking down South Ave, and they had cameras, and I remember my son was with them, and the girls had their hijabs on, and all had cameras and were photographing, and we're all alike. And I remember seeing my son interacting with them and them photographing the same things with the same questions. So for me, it's about if I'm doing something like that, I talk about, you know, architecture and lines and people, and also asking permission if you're photographing people, the ethics involved. One of the projects that I'd like to work on, I used to live over on Fulton Ave in the city, which was an amazing experience for me. And the group of kids that are over there, I've talked about getting cameras or having them use their cell phones where I can put cameras in their hands. As we all have our ideas on what the kids on the corner are doing. You know, the thugs, the drugs is what I hear a lot in these neighborhoods. But have them photograph their life at home, because they've got mothers and sisters and brothers. A lot of times they have fathers that have passed away, and they're the ones that are now taking care of that family the best way they know how at a young age, without role models. So the idea for me is, as a middle-aged white woman in America, I have my view. my view is a little bit different because I've immersed with these people. But if I go on that view of photos of, you know, what they're doing, you know, the things that they're doing outside, and then the, next to that on the wall sits their photos of dinner and their mom and, you know, going to school and playing basketball or whatever they do, playing chess, anything, it's two completely different stories. And I think what we're missing, my belief is that we only see outwardly when we drive by what we see. Mm-hmm. We have no idea what's on the other side, the reasons why. And again, it goes back to listening. So really quick, that same group of boys, when I was living over there, I had a wooden fence in the back of my the house that I rented, and I would garden in it. Well, right behind my fence was an abandoned lot, and in the driveway, the guys would play dice. They spent their days on the corner, cameras all around, and they would play dice, and I would listen. So I got to know their names before I got to know them, and they would do rap battles late at night, and I'd have my window open, and I would hear it. So I wasn't seeing them on the corner. I was hearing, I have three sons. I was hearing my sons hang out and play and have a good time in that. And so when I finally approached them, I was like, yeah, like, I know you guys. I know your names. I know what you do. I love this. I love that. And I recently talked with one of the a gentleman that lives over there, Jamal, and we had talked about doing this project together because I want it to be their story, their words. So there is not going to be any guidance in that. They're going to take photos of, you know, and put those together. Long story short.
No, thank you for sharing. We're down to our last couple of minutes, so I just want to quickly go around the table and have each of you share anything you're working on now that's open to the public or websites you'd like to share. Where can people find your work? I'll start with you, Dick.
Well, I'm just strictly painting, and I couldn't tell you what subject I'm on now because I'm in between paintings, but that's what I tend to do, spend as much time as possible. And I was just going to say that if you're doing an illustration as a freelancer, you're at a disadvantage. But if you work for an institution, what you say can get out in the public because you're there working for them and they publish it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Allie, remind us of where your exhibit is and when.
Yep, our exhibit is the opening reception, I should say, is this coming Friday, the 3rd, Williams Gallery, Unitarian Church, 6 to 9. Thank Be you. There.
Arlene, where's your website?
Website, arlenethaler.com. I'm currently working on human trafficking is ongoing, and I am on a mission to raise an awareness about litter.
So and Jonathan, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're down to our last couple minutes. Jonathan, we'll find you on Twitter. Thank you for listening to Members.